We have a theater opening this weekend, Dancing at Lunasa, a highly regarded play, and you're going to find out why after we talk about it for a while, if you don't already know of that play. But it is opening at Gonzaga University's new performing arts space, the Myrtle Woldson Theater, that magnificent theater that is just across the lawn from the Junt Arts Center. And it's quite a production, as also you're going to find out. But let's enter into the feeling of this. A certain main character who is or isn't there in a way is the character of Michael, here played by Brett Bean. So let's get a sense of Dancing at Lunasa.
And so, when I cast my mind back to that summer of 1936, these two memories of our first wireless and of Father Jack's return are always linked, so that when I remember my first shock at Father Jack's appearance, all shrunken and jaundiced with malaria, at the same time I remember my first delight, indeed my awe, at the sheer magic of that radio. And when I remember our kitchen throbbing with the beat of Irish dance music, beamed to us all the way from Athlone, and my mother and her sisters catching hands and breaking into a spontaneous step dance, laughing, screaming, like excited schoolgirls. At the same time, I see that forlorn figure of Father Jack shuffling from room to room like he was searching for something, but couldn't remember what. And even though I was only a child of 7 years old at the time, I know I had a growing sense of unease, a sort of widening breach between what seemed to be and what was, and of things becoming what they were not meant to be. Perhaps it was because Father Jack hadn't turned out anything like the resplendent figure in my head, or maybe it was because I had witnessed Marconi's voodoo derange those kind, sensible women and transform them into shrieking strangers. Or maybe it was because during those Lunasa weeks of 1936, we were visited on two separate occasions by my father, Jerry Evans, and for the first time in my life, I had the chance to observe him.
Brett Bean as Michael in Dancing with Lunasa, which opens this Friday, Saturday night at 7:30, Sunday at 2 this weekend and next. Jack Delahunty, good morning. And you have the honor, isn't it, to direct this play?
It really is an honor. Yeah, and it's one that I've been wanting to be involved with for a very long time.
And already from what we heard, those words are so potent. So many issues and things happened just within the minute and a half that we heard, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. And I think the beauty of Brian Friel's writing, his language, his use of language, much like John Millington Synge or other Irish playwrights, it's just so beautiful as he tries to deal with family and communication and really the soul, the Irish soul, that's filled with such a balance of sorrow and joy. And I think that's what he really captures in this play, is that you can't have one without the other. Yeah. The Irish soul doesn't believe that you really have a full life if you don't have that balance of sorrow and joy.
And so we'll get into both aspects of that, of Dancing with Lunasa. Why don't you outline the major characters or character groups first, exactly how in the play we do and don't meet the character of Michael, who was played so beautifully by Brett Bean just now.
Yeah, it's much like the character of Tom in Glass Menagerie. Michael takes us back to 1936 Donegal, when he was growing up with his mother, who was not married, and his four aunts. It's really the story of those five women and their struggle. And as you know, an unwed mother in 1936 Ireland, if the family didn't protect her, it was a sorry lot for her. So it's really the story of those five sisters, and how they struggle and yet how they celebrate and how they live their life with some semblance of joy, even though they are not destitute, but certainly struggling. Mm. And Michael, in his opening monologue, which you heard part of, takes us back to that time. And then he moves in and out. Sometimes he's the narrator voice that you just heard. Sometimes the sisters talk to him as a young 7-year-old boy. And Michael, the older Michael, speaks for the little boy, not in his voice, but in his memory of what took place.
And then he also made reference to the pathetic figure of Father Jack.
Mm-hmm. And Jack is the older brother, and he left for Africa to work in a leper colony 25 years ago. He returns really having gone native and also, unfortunately, has malaria. And so he's weakened. He's not sure where he is or how to speak the language anymore. He's lost his Irish accent and much of his vocabulary. So to see that man, who the young 7-year-old boy remembered as such a magnificent character when he left, such a powerful character, and the whole community, really, in Donegal, felt that way about Jack. And certainly the change in him when he returns, and the sisters having to deal with this man that they so admired and so loved, having become such a shadow of himself.
Jack Delahunty, on kind of a great overview of some of the issues of this play, Dancing at Lunasa. And then in terms of the production, which is in this new Myrtle Woldson Theatre, so all of a sudden you have the not only the possibility but the challenge of ennobling such a great space. And so you went all out with music, right?
We did.
Okay,
yeah.
And let's bring James Hunter in here, because the highly regarded Irish band Floating Crowbar is playing the entire group of shows, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And so that alone, so that really makes it a different level of play, doesn't it, Jack?
It really does. I made the decision. Normally, the music in the show comes over the radio, mm-hmm. which is talked about by Michael in this
Marconi.
Beginning. The Marconi. And I decided that I really wanted to add a more immediate sense of the music. And so I asked James and the others if they would be willing to join us in this endeavor. And fortunately for us, they said yes. And so they provide all the live music, not only the dance music within the show, but our pre-show music and all of the beautiful air that you heard some of just now, that is under all of Michael's monologues.
And so the creative process of doing that, don't go away too far at any point, Jack. How did this work through, James?
It was very collaborative, actually. When Jack said that he was interested in this, I gave him all of our recorded music and said, anything you want from this. We'd prefer to play this music because it is traditional and authentic, rather than learn something, for example, in the movie, that's a modern this modern music that's been written specifically for the movie. So Jack listened to that and also shared it with Clara Buck, the choreographer, who picked out pieces from various of our recordings. And then, as Jack said, the music in this is really, we're at the Marconi. We're sitting actually physically behind Marconi. So most of the music that we provide is supposed to be coming out of the radio. But Jack made a decision that he wanted Michael's monologues to have music behind them too,
and as we just heard.
Right, and mm-hmm. that's the piece that we're playing, and it's a very old air called in Gaelic it's see if I can get this right, Cio Drechta Cio Icha Cumfagomi, which means it was a magic mist that put me astray one night. Which just the title alone is like, what on earth does that mean? And it's very dreamlike and so forth. But even prior to knowing that, the first time Jack came around to meet the band and to talk about music, we just happened to be playing that because Morgan Anderson, our fiddle player, really loves that particular air, and he was trying to get us to learn it. And Jack came in and said, yep, that's what we're going to use for the play. So that's how that came about. And that's, like I said, that's a very old air from... But it was old when it was collected in the mid, it was probably 1860s by Canon James. Sorry, his name just went out of my head. Who was a collector, kind of ethnomusicographer at the time. We'll come back in a sec.
And then you're also the dance band.
And we're also the dance band, yeah. So when the sisters turn on the radio, they finally get it working long enough for an actual music to come out. Then we play a dance piece from, it's called Down the Lane, and it's a very wild jig that develops and gets wilder as it goes along, so they get carried away by it.
And so there is that jig that, and not able to help themselves, dancing along to it are two of the sisters, of the five sisters in this play, Molly Quillen as Kate and Molly Henderson as Agnes. So the oldest sister, Kate, Molly. First, good morning, Molly.
Good morning. Hi.
And let's kind of talk about. Talk about who Kate is and what her role is. It's kind of the classic oldest kid has to bear the responsibility and burden deal, isn't it?
Absolutely. Kate is, as you said, the oldest sister. Her older brother is Jack, who went away to Uganda to be in a leper colony. So when Jack left and their parents died, Kate really shouldered all of the responsibility of the family and taking care of the sisters and... she's a national school teacher, so she is one of the only sisters with a true job. Agnes, actually Molly here, she is knits gloves, but that really supports only her and our other sister Rose, and my job kind of supports the rest of the family. So Kate is kind of the crux of the family and holds everything together and takes everything on her back to support everybody in the family, and she takes everything very seriously and wants to care for the sisters very much.
I mean, I think that starts to be the answer to my next question. What is the price of that responsibility?
Yes, it's a heavy burden for Kate to carry. It's exhausting for her and very difficult, but she loves her sisters so much, and that's what drives her to care for them so much and to be so hard on them and so strict. But she does wind up about three quarters of the way through Act One, she does wind up collapsing for fear of the future, for fear of everything falling apart. And that's been something that I've really tried to work on with Kate, is keeping that arc in her and having things seem okay and move forward in the beginning, but then slowly she sees that things might start to fall apart. So putting that into Kate has been really interesting, and she's very concerned for her sisters, so she loves them very much.
Molly Quillen as Kate. So Molly Henderson as Agnes. I mean, we already profile you that if you kind of pick up a little money for the family by making gloves, you're probably kind of artsy and not real reliable and make gloves when you feel like it. Or I don't know, tell me about Agnes.
Yeah, so most of my duties throughout the day just include me making gloves and really taking care of Rose, one of the other sisters.
And why does Rose need to be taken care of?
So what Brian Friel describes her as, simple, or she's kind of slow. She needs help. She's not like the other sisters, and sometimes she gets teased and picked on, and I usually take the responsibility of taking care of her as my character, and she helps me make gloves, and we make gloves together, and we just work together, and I have to make sure she's okay.
So there are two other sisters with reference to the third. Then that leaves two more sisters, right?
Yes.
So tell me who they are.
So we're missing Maggie today. Maggie is our the joker of the family.
Yes, the joker.
Michael describes her in his first monologue. But Maggie keeps us lively and jokes around. And specifically with Kate, she knows how to push all of Kate's buttons. So she knows exactly what to say to diffuse every moment when Kate's being especially hard on the sisters. And she knows how to lighten the mood and always make us laugh, which is really sweet. And then we're also missing Chris, who, Molly, do you want to describe
Chris?
Yeah,
so Chris is the youngest sister, and she's the father. I mean, no, the mother. She is not the father. She's the mother of Michael, who the story, you know, is narrated by. And she falls in love with Jerry Evans, and he's kind of not the best, but you learn that throughout the play. And she just kind of takes care of everyone, and she's just like the younger sister, the youngest child.
And I like to describe Chris too as kind of like floating. Like she floats through the play like she's in a dream, but more in like a lovely, lovely dream that she loves. She just exudes love in all situations. It's really sweet.
Well, let's bring Brett, come back toward a microphone so that we have of the people that came here today, the three actors, because already there's been reference to then things are going to turn sour, or we wouldn't have good drama if they didn't. So is it the return of Father Jack, or what sets off the decline in tension in this play, either among you three to talk about or you, Jack? Go ahead, Brett.
Yeah, I can take it. I think it's interesting in that everything in this play, like, at least for me, Michael's such an interesting character because he really, other than voicing like his young self, like I think four times throughout the play, like briefly, he really only comes in to deliver five like very long monologues. And I think we sort of see there's a sense of like, oh, like there's a little bit of unease. He talks about that in the first piece that I did at the top of the show. And as the show goes on, like those monologues get increasingly darker as he's talking about sort of the future and what lies in store. And I think that the play sort of reflects that as you move through it. Like much in the first act, you see a lot of these cracks of like, oh, Father Jack's back, but he's not quite right. Not everything's kind of right with him. Or, you know, Jerry Evans, my father, is back in town. He's visiting, but there's all this unease with him. He's probably going to leave again, or what's that going to cause? And then you see, like, Agnes and Rose with, like, is Agnes, like, dissatisfied at the house? Like, does she want to get away? Sort of what's that looking like? There's all of this sort of, like, growing just unease and, like, tension between the sisters and Father Jack and Jerry Evans. And sort of Michael's just observing all of that, both as a young child and just through his memory. And he sort of gets to see all of these things compile together and then look to the future and sort of see it all fall apart. Because we don't necessarily see it fall apart in the play. We just see it kind of coming, but then Michael sort of lets us know like what happens after, and you know what happens after isn't always happy. Even though like the end of the play, from what we see in his memory, is a very, you know, sort of happier moment, it's what lies beyond that.
So back to you, Jack Delahunty, the director of this play. There's unique things in this play in that it doesn't follow just kind of the normal, you know, introduce some stuff, have a big problem, get it solved, and you're done. Talk a little bit more about how the play has all of these levels, the things that Brett already refers to, the nagging questions that are still going to come along. Talk about this stuff.
Yeah, I think, Brett certainly, touched on that. Again, if I go back to that sense of sorrow and joy, I think Brian Friel is playing with that, in that we see these struggles and we see, the return of Jack not being what everybody expected. At one point, Rose, the one that everybody kind of feels they have to take care of, disappears, and the panic that goes through the family when that happens, and then the return of Jerry Evans, and he kind of comes and goes, excuse me, and that's disturbing to Kate and the rest of the sisters, who don't have much respect for him because they don't feel he's taken his responsibility. And yet mixed in with that, as soon as we start to feel, sad and down and dark, all of a sudden there's an exuberant dance. There's an uplifting moment. Maggie makes jokes. And so that it balances out with that joy. And like Brett just explained, at the end of the play is a very kind of joyful moment that we see. And yet, with that joyful moment, he also tells us what's coming. Mm-hmm. And so I think he goes back and forth with that to reveal to us that really the depth of the Irish soul that has always felt that life was only full when that happened. And that you were really only fully human when you experienced both a balance of sorrow and joy. One can't come without the other. There is one moment I'd like to mention that really foreshadows, I think, how the family becomes broken. And that's when Rose disappears up in the hills. And the sisters literally go into an incredible panic. What would happen if something did happen to Rose? And so that, tied with the other things that seem to be breaking apart, suggest. And then we see Kate fall so much apart that Maggie, the one who's been the jokester and the one who always makes light of everything, needs to take the family together and take over Kate's role. So it's just the language itself is just wonderful. Brian Friel, if you know any of his other plays, can't pull them out of my old head right now, but Philadelphia, Here I Come, for example, and Molly Sweeney, and more recently Translations, Freedom in the City. They all deal with the same thing, the crisis in the family, the balance in life between sorrow and joy. So I do have to say that I don't know how I got so fortunate as to work with this group of students. Mm-hmm. They're an incredible ensemble, every single one of them. And they have captured the language and the sense of character and the sense of Brian Friel's play in such a remarkable way. I'm very proud of them.
Well, it sounds like the play couldn't handle a weak performance that wouldn't work, would it?
It wouldn't.
Yeah.
It wouldn't.
And before we amplify that a little bit more, one other place I want to go, and that is, what about the conflict aspects of Father Jack and what he was and what he has become, and the issues of the church and the nativism and all of that that's going on through this?
Yeah, I think that's the most difficult thing, and Molly could probably speak to that too. The most difficult thing for her to accept is that he's no longer the priest that everybody so admired and had such respect for. She finally has to come to some sense that, well, he's following his own spirituality, and I guess I can deal with that, but she really can't. He doesn't really separate the family. He just kind of is that symbol that life is no longer going to be what it was before. It's different. It's different for Jack, and because it's different for Jack, he makes it different for everyone else. But he's a gentle, kind man, even on his return. You can't help but love his love of what he did and the people that he worked with. So it's the challenge is that we have a very young actor playing a man who's 53 years old, and Daniel does a wonderful job of giving us that sense of being ill, being old, and being confused and lost at that moment.
Yes, Dancing at Lunasa opening Saturday night at 7:30, and then Friday night at 7:30, Saturday night at 7:30, Sunday at 2, and then repeated the following weekend. Let's bring in Freya Jarvegren-Euker, who's the stage manager, and and Jack kind of talk about the relevance of the whole production and what you're doing as you introduce Freya to us.
Well, I would say I have to say that probably like every production, when you have a strong stage manager, we all depend on her. She's kind of the glue that holds everything together. She's the one who has to know every single cue in the show. She's the one who has to understand not just her character, like the actors do, but she has to understand every character. She not only has to remember what her director put down in terms of blocking, but she also has to see the opportunities for altering that, changing it, building on what the director has begun. This particular stage manager, I think everybody in the cast and crew would agree, has taken on that role and done a double time. We really all depend on her.
So tell me about yourself, Freya. Are you, what are you majoring in at Gonzaga?
Well, I am a public relations major, and I am a technical theater major as well, okay, with a visual literacy minor.
So this is fitting exactly,
yeah,
in many ways.
And it's getting me credits towards my major.
That too.
So, nice.
So is this the first time for you to do this precise job, to be a stage manager in a major production?
I started stage managing in high school, probably about my freshman year. I was kind of the assistant and then eventually took on the actual role of stage manager. And then I did some community stage management before I came here.
And where was that?
I'm from Port Angeles, Washington.
Oh, okay.
So we just kind of have little local theaters. We do like Shakespeare in the Park in the summer and things like that.
Is Port Angeles kind of the Ireland of Washington? I don't know.
I don't know if I would go that far. It's kind of the nowhere of Washington, actually.
We won't tell them.
Yeah. this is my second stage management show at Gonzaga.
Nice.
Yeah.
And then kind of rotating back around to doing it in this theater. This is one of the very, very first major plays to be done in this theater, I presume. Maybe there's been one or two more.
Yeah, the fall production, Romeo and Juliet, was the one that actually, for the theater department, opened that space. And so this is the second one.
Any unique challenges, or are you just you want to play?
There are some unique challenges. It's an incredibly beautiful theater. It seats over 800 people, so it's very large. It has a mammoth stage with a full retractable apron. It also has its challenges in that respect. Because it's so large, you're asking young actors to really learn how to project and support their voice. And so they're not only working on their character and their lines and their blocking.
And their accent.
And their accent, yeah. But now they also have to, you know, project to the back of this huge theater. So that's one of the challenges. The other one is it's such a large stage and a big auditorium that doing a more intimate play like this, how do you get that sense of intimacy and the audience close when there's hopefully 800 of them out there? So that's a challenge. It also was designed with a fire curtain, and so it has a trench that runs along the entire stage. And so in terms of design, you have to design a set that doesn't interfere with that fire curtain coming down the middle. That presents some design problems as well. That balanced with the fact that you have an incredibly lighting system and sound system and beautiful acoustics, it has its upside as well as its challenges.
And I think it's appropriate that uniquely today we're talking about the theater, which is named the Father Coughlin Theater at the Myrtle Woldson Performing Arts Center there at Gonzaga University. Well, we could be utterly authentically Irish and keep talking and talking and talking, but probably we won't, because I think the story's gotten told well. Thank you, each of you, in your unique way that you've brought this story to us. So once again, opening Friday night, 7:30, and Friday night, Saturday night, then Sunday afternoon for this weekend and next. So that is Dancing at Lunasa. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.